Happy Thursday!
Thursday.
Oh my gosh, why are we just saying that now?
Because it's been a really long couple fucking weeks.
Well, we have some exciting news to share with you guys. What's your
exciting news, Amy?
Well, you know, COVID is like a thing, right? Like everybody knows about it at this point. Well, a lot of people don't know that I have an elderly father. He's actually 83 years old. And I got to see him last night for the first time since January.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it wasn't specifically a meeting that we were setting up to like hang out. I actually ran an errand for him, but it was nice. And he came outside on his step and he's not allowing anybody into the house. So,
sure.
You know, we just got to chat with him for a little bit and it was nice.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's so awesome. I found out that I'm going to be a part of my best friend's proposal this weekend because my brother is the one that's proposing to her.
Oh my gosh. This is so exciting.
I'll have to tell you guys all about it next week.
I'm very excited.
This is happening on Sunday, so stay tuned.
Yes, couple of days.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for tuning in to episode 6 of Sheer Crime. We are covering part 5 of the trials of Gabriel Fernandez. In this episode, we hear the transcribed testimony of Gabriel's siblings, Ezekiel and Virginia. And boy, this is tough to hear.
That one was hard.
It made me cry. Mm-hmm. And it was horrible.
Yeah. It's so much harder coming from such a small voice.
Right.
You know?
And you can tell that they know that they don't have to lie anymore about what's happening or what happened to them.
There was a relief you could feel.
Absolutely. And, you know, we actually get their account of what happened the night Gabriel died.
Yeah.
And it's horrifying, as you can imagine.
Well, and since it is Thirsty Thursday, what did you bring? Because I need something.
Me too. Well, you guys, I'm going back to our use, the Crooked Marker.
Got my favorite.
This time, we are trying the blueberry lemonade flavor.
What?
I know. So, we haven't had the lemonade before.
No.
So, this will be very interesting. I'm excited.
I cannot wait. Let's pop them tops.
Let's do it.
Here I am struggling again. There we go.
Oh, Amy. It's okay. Ugh. It's okay. As long as it opens,
nails
right?
Nails are just screwing me.
Hmm.
That is so different.
That is not at all what I thought it would be.
There's no bubbles.
No bubbles. Actually doesn't really taste like lemonade to me at all.
No, but
it tastes a lot more of the blueberry. It's like a hint, undertone
it's
kind
like
of thing.
Juice.
Very good.
I really like this.
Nice choice.
This is going to be great for podcasting because no burps.
Yes. That's been the problem for me sometimes. So
yeah. So if you ever hear that, you guys, just keep it to yourselves. So part 5 starts off, obviously the title of this episode is Improper Regard or Indifference, which we find out a little bit moving into the episode that that's actually kind of a part of a quote that Judge Lomelli says during one of his statements to the court.
And I was a little confused by it at first. I'm like, that's an interesting name. But you understand as you go through the episode, it makes more sense.
It totally makes sense. Yeah. The other ones were kind of more cut and dry, and this one was like,
yeah,
huh?
Yep. This made you think a little bit.
A little bit. The first person that we come in contact with is Milka Aguilar. Now, she is a social worker through DCFS. She's in the Emergency Response Command Post. So she's that first line of defense, right? The call comes in. She's the one that's answering it. She's the one that's going to the house, and she's checking out the situation.
Exactly. Very much like Stephanie Rodriguez and Patricia Clement.
Right.
Same type of position that she's holding.
Yes. So they have a camera crew kind of following her on one of these home welfare checks. And she's talking about how at this particular one, they're actually doing an out-of-home abuse investigation, which means that they're actually investigating the foster parents of a child that's been placed in the system.
Yes.
So this isn't the biological parent. This is somebody who is taking care of this child. This is somebody who's been vetted by DCFS as being a safe haven for a child in need. So what you see is her getting to this home, and she's going to interview any adults separately. She's going to also then see and view the child. Now, in this particular case, the child is only about 5 or 6 months old.
That scared the shit out of me.
Right.
I was like, oh my God, what are we going to see?
I know.
What's going to happen? What kind of situation is this?
Totally.
I'm like bracing myself. I'm like 5 months old. That's a tiny baby.
That's a tiny baby.
Yes.
And I had goosebumps, and I do right now. Even just thinking about that moment where I was like, oh shit, what am I about to see?
Oh.
Because like, come on, give us a warning.
Oh yeah. Well, you have no idea what they're about to walk into or what they're going to actually see.
Absolutely.
Clearly, we don't see the baby. But
right. Yep.
It, still, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know what Netflix is going to do to you.
Netflix has done quite a bit to me.
Too much.
I have PTSD from Netflix. Okay. So she gets to the house and she is interviewing this foster parent about a domestic violence allegation regarding herself and her ex-girlfriend. So a neighbor had called in. There had been like a domestic disturbance. They were seen fighting. There was a couple of different allegations, it sounds like.
Yeah.
A couple of different instances. And one of them had to do with the two women outside fighting near the vehicle. One of them was holding the baby in the car seat. So I'm assuming it's an infant car seat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is an infant.
Right.
And the neighbor claims that the infant car seat is dropped on the ground. So with that, even though the child itself wasn't directly struck,
yep.
There has to be a case. There has to be an interview.
And I think there's concern. General concern from a normal adult human being seeing this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Milka comes in. It seems like the foster parent is actually kind of surprised that she's there.
Yep.
It seems like a very calm situation. From what you see, this foster parent is home alone with the infant. Doesn't seem like anything's going on. It doesn't even sound like there's a TV on in the background. So
yep.
Very, very calm. And she seems to be very cooperative as well.
And she almost seems to like laugh it off a little bit when she hears that someone called.
Yes.
About that. Whatever had happened, when it did happen, she didn't think it was a big deal, but someone else did.
Absolutely.
So, and I don't think it was in a bad way that she laughed it off, but she was like that shocked that someone had actually called in regards to that incident that happened that day.
Yes. And I don't believe I brought this up, but it sounds like Milka also kind of showed up around like 9:30 p.m.
Yes.
So she does immediately kind of apologize for the time that she's showing up, but it must have happened at a point where she just needed to get over there right now.
Yep. Well, especially for that age of a baby.
Yes.
I mean, you have to be certain that that baby's okay, that the baby's still breathing, that the baby's not hurt.
They can't talk for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. So she goes in and she's doing a welfare check of the house. And I thought it was very interesting. She's going through. She's literally checking the fridge to see if there's food. She's checking to see that there's enough formula because obviously this baby is not fully on solid foods.
Mm-hmm.
She's checking to make sure that the gas works. So the stove is lighting. She's checking to make sure that the water runs in the kitchen and in the bathrooms. She's checking cabinets. She's checking everything, which I just in my head, I didn't think that's what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
However, I love it.
She's a fucking hero.
For real.
People need to follow in her footsteps because clearly this was not happening at all in Gabriel's case.
Right.
When it easily could have.
Should have.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
Because at this point, too, Milka asks to see the baby because of the apparent car seat being dropped.
Yep.
And she says, you know, I'm just going to have to have you unclothe her and you check her nude and you see her saying, you know, oh my gosh, what a beautiful smiley baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then she talks about how robust of a child it
is. Yeah, she used the word robust.
She uses robust like at least twice, I
think. Yeah.
And I actually kind of like that because in a baby, obviously they're going to cry, you know, at the drop of a hat, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times they can't tell you if they're hungry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where a small child could tell you or have signs that they're hungry. With a baby, if a baby is starving, they're not going to be putting on weight. They're not going to be considered
robust. It'll be visible.
Robust. Yeah.
Yes, they'll be skinny. You could easily tell. But she said that she was a very big and healthy baby.
Yeah.
So
she seemed pretty happy about that as well. And she also seemed very appreciative of the cooperation of the foster parent. And basically what Milka says at the end of it is she says, you know, we go in, we look for any evidence of abuse. And this time I didn't see any.
Mm-hmm.
But she went in, she did her check. I feel like this should be done all the time.
Well, and she even says that when you get allegations of domestic abuse or violence, you have to look for the evidence, i.e. in the home. And this foster parent had no drugs, no alcohol, a lot of food.
Yep.
And the baby was, quote unquote, robust.
Right.
She did everything in her power to ensure that that baby was safe. And she knew that there was no harm being done to that baby.
Right.
And she had no immediate concerns for that baby's safety and or health.
Yeah.
Which is what her job title is and what she needs to do. And I just don't understand how Gabriel got passed over.
I know.
It doesn't make any sense to me. I still, and I'm going to say it 500 more times, none of this fucking makes sense.
No, I think it truly speaks to a laziness on the part of the social workers. I mean, we're going to get into it later, but just the fact that Milka goes in and looks head to toe at this baby to make sure there is not a scratch that can't be accounted for, that doesn't happen with Gabriel. We already know that hasn't happened. So with that being said, what the fuck were they doing?
I don't know. It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
Totally bizarre.
Now, we start back, actually, on that phone call we ended on last week.
Yes.
To Patricia Clement, the former DCFS worker, and Mary Chenevich, the investigator from LA County District Attorney's Office, was the one calling her.
Right.
And basically, Patricia had said, "What are you calling me about?" And they wanted to speak to her about her prior employment.
Sure.
And Patricia says, "Are you going to charge me with something? Is this regarding the little boy? I didn't have anything to do with that. They're lying." And she sounds frantic on the phone.
I mean,
0 to 100, crying all over the place, high-pitched voice, stumbling her words. It was everything.
Yep.
Crazy. She was very frantic.
Very much so.
Then we hear her say, "Oh God, they're the district attorney's office. Oh God."
Yeah.
You can tell that now this is all elevated for her.
Yep.
She had just been getting internal interviews from DCFS.
Right.
The actual government had not gotten involved yet. The district attorney's office hadn't gotten involved yet.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes wonder if that was the point where she was like, shit, this is going to be like a court thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it scared her. And because she's older. She's an older lady. And I'm clearly terrible at guessing ages. So I can't even begin to try and guess her age.
Easily, she's over 60. Easily.
Yeah.
Yep. Easily over 60, but they don't actually say her age. She looks older to me than Greg Merritt.
I would say so, too.
And Greg said he was 62.
Yep.
So in my head, she's mid to late 60s.
That's what I was kind of thinking, too.
Yeah. Or she just does not take care of herself.
Now, we get to the social worker's pre-trial hearing to dismiss at the LA County's Clara Foltz Criminal Justice Center. And we see all the social workers filing in to the courtroom. We get James Barnes. He's the attorney for Greg Merritt. So the defense filed a motion to dismiss on grounds that there wasn't sufficient evidence to stand on trial. And we had heard about that earlier in the series. Then we get, I'm going to mess this up.
Yeah.
This is a hard name to pronounce. But we get Hagop Kayumjian, the attorney for Kevin Baum.
Yes. Sounds great. I love it.
Perfect. Perfect pronunciation of his name.
Oh, yeah. No one will correct you on that.
No. And basically, he's speaking to the judge about how these allegations should have never been filed and that, again, the case needs to be dismissed. And if you recall, they are being charged with child endangerment resulting in death and falsifying public records. Where is the line from negligence and mistakes to gross negligence and recklessness? That's kind of that fine line that they're all riding right now.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get the judge to side with them that it was a mistake.
Right. We then have Garrett Theralf, you know, his talking head coming in again. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, after Gabriel's death, the social workers had to sit down with Internal Affairs, or IA, investigations, and it was a condition of their employment. They had to sit down with them. They had to have all of these taped interviews. And up until this point, the tapes were kept out of a criminal trial because it was an internal investigation. But at the same time, why are we taping it?
Right. Well, and you could tell, and even Garrett said that none of the social workers wanted to do this.
Oh, can you believe?
They were like, please, no. But obviously they had to. They didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
It was part of their job description.
Yeah. So then we start hearing some of the recordings from these taped interviews. Mm-hmm. And I believe these were done right around like June of 2013. So very, very shortly after Gabriel's death and after everything had kind of come to light that somewhere the shoe was dropped.
Yeah.
And who did that?
Yeah. Whose fault is it?
Yeah. So the first one that we hear is Patricia Clement. And you hear her saying that, you know, he was acting up in school, that he had and was angry, was rude to his teacher. And the interviewer says, well, where, who said this? And she was like, well, those things were told to me by the mom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So first of all, we don't hear anything about him being angry or rude to his teacher. What we had heard earlier was that he had had a couple of outbursts.
Mm-hmm.
And even that was surprising because it was so out of character for him.
Right.
So right there, we know that Pearl was manipulating the social workers. I mean, we already knew, right?
Is she like a hypnotist or what the fuck is happening?
I don't understand. So at first, when we were talking about how she had gotten, you know, this quote unquote naive and innocent Izarro to do all these things, it's like, does this chick just have like a golden vagina? Like, what is going on? But now she's doing it with social workers. None of them are sleeping with her.
None of it is fucking making any sense to me.
It doesn't
make
any
sense. Because again, she has an eighth grade education.
Well, and if you look at her, she doesn't scream Martha Stewart. She doesn't scream like, I'm a nice, friendly, approachable person. She screams aggression.
Yep.
So I don't understand. And honestly, we are women. When we see women like that, you're not as inclined to want to be super friendly with them.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So this all just doesn't add up to me.
Very crazy.
And again, it just kind of leads me more along the lines of there was a lot of lazy fucking work going on.
Yep.
So lazy work. Is that even a thing? Laziness in the job. There is no lazy work. Work is work. My God.
Okay. I gotcha.
You knew what I meant. So there was never any, you know, speaking to the teacher or follow up with the school from Patricia either. So it wasn't even like she heard this and was like, okay, let me just make sure.
Let me verify these claims and make sure that the mom is actually telling me the truth.
Yeah, she never did that.
No, Pearl is constantly lying. I mean, I'm sure she is a compulsive liar. I'm sure Pearl believes her own lies after a while.
I think at this point, that's all she has to live on.
Yeah, because that's her whole life is revolved around that at this point.
Yeah, totally. And then we also get some recordings from Greg Merritt at the same time. They're kind of flip-flopping back and forth.
Yep.
And Greg, when he's asked about verification that there were no incidents of physical abuse obtained, he says it was never brought to my attention by the social worker. And also, it's very important to note that he never specifically asked his social worker about these allegations of physical abuse. They knew that there was some abuse going on, but again, nobody talked about it.
And he said he can't remember a lot. And I don't like that answer.
I don't, but you know what? Remember that he was a supervisor of six social workers who had 30
and
plus
he had 300,
cases each.
And he had like 380 or so that he was.
Right. So,
or was it 280?
280. Something. Yeah, 280 at the highest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those things where it's like, yes, I don't like that answer. It sounds so like lackadaisical. However, it's probably fucking true.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have one child and half the time I don't remember what she says to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine.
Next on screen, we see Jackie Lacey again, the district attorney for LA County. She said that they had evaluated everyone involved in Gabriel's case and they were looking for violations of the law. And based on that, they filed the case. They obviously thought there was negligence. Obviously, there were some missteps and big mistakes were made.
What?
This child lost his life.
Yeah.
And there was countless times they could have done more and they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. So we're back in the courtroom and we see Stephanie Rodriguez's attorney, Lance Filer. He is speaking on her behalf to the judge, of course. And he's explaining how she only had contact with Gabriel's family from October 30th, 2012 to January 31st, 2013. And that all the injuries after that date are irrelevant to Stephanie. Okay.
I kind of get that.
I get it. Where he's putting into context when she actually had his file and that anything in between those times obviously would be relevant to her, but anything after wouldn't pertain to her.
Sure. I mean, I get it.
I get it too.
Yeah.
And basically, Lance Filer threw all the other DCF workers and officers under the bus. Yeah. That was his whole game plan. Just fucking throw everyone else under the bus. Get Stephanie off. Everyone else under the bus. It's everyone else's fault but hers.
I actually kind of liked how he did
that. I know. And he didn't give two fucks about it.
Yeah, Lance Filer, the attorney, even goes so far as to name, not specifically, but starts listing off.
Yes,
so
he
says there were three other supervisors, two other social workers, one emergency response worker, two other mental health professionals, two law enforcement officers, all of them mandated reporters who did nothing.
Yeah.
After the point of Stephanie, you know, no longer having this case, which essentially if it was January 31st, okay, we're talking February 1st. So right. From February 1st until the date of his death, all of these other people were involved. Why is Stephanie here is right. Kind of where he's going with it, right?
I mean, it's a pretty smart play that he took because it does reiterate the fact that it's not just about her.
100%.
There's a lot of other people that were involved that did not step in and do something.
Yes.
Now, Garrett goes back and states that Stephanie was one of the new recruits. When we had talked about how they were getting these new social workers and then literally putting them right into the emergency response section
and
having them on the front line.
Talk about being in the shark tank.
Exactly. And I mean, she didn't have a lot of experience anyway doing that. So it doesn't make none of that makes sense to me, too.
No.
And unfortunately, she just didn't dig deep enough. Mm-hmm. Right. And they said that she was really gullible and easily manipulated by Pearl Fernandez. Again, she must have her verbiage down well enough to know exactly what to say to DCFS to get them off her ass.
Yeah.
I don't understand it otherwise. And maybe too, being naive and gullible and new to the situation, Stephanie just went ahead and believed the parent, right? Well,
and I also got this like image in my head because they show a picture of Stephanie. She looks very sweet, very nice. She's a pretty young lady. Did I just say that? God, that sounded so old. But she's, you know, she's young, she's cute, she's fresh. And again, we talk about what Pearl looked like, mm-hmm. right? In my head, immediately, I sense a fear. Pearl is intimidating as fuck.
Yep.
And I would not be surprised if she gives off that I will cut a bitch attitude. And
I'm sure she does.
If it were Stephanie coming up to her, I could easily see that being a power struggle and Stephanie easily backing down.
For sure.
Because she's brand new.
Yeah.
And like they said, a social worker's job is not the safest. You could be attacked.
Right.
Maybe she was just scared.
You know, I didn't think about it that way. And if she didn't have backup or if she didn't have an officer with her or someone with her
I bet she was alone.
I'm sure she was alone. So it's like, I do get that because where they lived, the area they lived in, and Pearl herself, it's intimidating and it's
absolutely
scary.
Yeah. Yeah, and if that person is telling you everything's fine, hands up and back away, right?
Right, right, which is unfortunate, but
absolutely.
I'm sure that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Now, we did hear that Stephanie had notes, and she had reasons written down for Gabriel's injuries.
Right.
So, one was he hurt himself. He bumped into a corner of a door, fallen off the top of the bunk bed. So, of course,
I mean,
Pearl,
these are normal childhood injuries.
For sure. And I'm sure Pearl was feeding her these reasons.
Yeah.
Of course.
Absolutely.
And now, when you are a social worker, you're supposed to do what's called body charts. So it's basically a chart and you're supposed to document all of the injuries that you see at that interview or at that appointment that you go to that person's house.
Yeah,
right?
It's like a picture of an outline of a body. You state the injury and then there's a little spot for you to notate what type of injury it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we hear that she does do this once, and this is with the belt buckle mark.
That's right.
So she did notate that, but never marked any other bruise or injury seen.
Which is so bizarre because that's the one that you can't see with just looking at him.
So it does make you think that she did do her due diligence to have him stripped down, you know, because otherwise she probably wouldn't have seen that, right?
Well, right.
So he probably had to strip down a little bit so she could see that injury. But it's kind of strange that I'm sure she saw bruises too. Maybe she thought they were just kid bruises, roughhousing with friends kind of thing. But if you're there for a welfare check, why not document them just in case?
All of them.
Yeah.
I would have documented everything.
I mean, just to go that extra mile and be like, just in case, that's not actually what happened. let's make sure it's on paper so we can remember what happened the day I went.
Absolutely. The executive director of the Children's Law Center of California, Leslie Hemov, then comes on the screen. And she's talking about how that reported shot to the face with a BB gun, the social worker just walks away from that. You know, there's notation that that was a BB gun shot to the face, but there's no body chart done on this.
Again, that's a part of their job when they go to interview this child or these people to make sure they're doing this welfare check correctly. I don't understand why this, we hear this now on multiple occasions that these body charts are not being done. And it's like, is it just because you don't want to be here anymore? You just want to leave, or you're supposed to be doing this?
Yeah. Well, and later on, I think we do find out why these body charts weren't being done, but we'll wait for a little bit to bring that up. So they're talking about how this is just not normal childhood injuries.
Right.
And of course, with a belt buckle, I mean, that's not a childhood injury. That's not they're running around playing and suddenly get struck by a belt.
Well, and I think when people think about like belt spankings or when that used to be something that adults would do, and they may still do that now.
Yeah.
It's with the leather part of the belt.
Exactly.
Not the belt buckle.
Right.
So that is meant for more of a torture and violent type of attack. I mean, there's a difference. There's a complete difference.
It's a sharp edge.
Right.
On skin.
Exactly.
Where the leather, generally, at least, you know, from what we know historically on all of these things, that would leave like a welt kind of a look. It wouldn't break skin generally.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, then we have the small talking head of this former colleague of the social workers. Her name is Shirley Darlene Starr.
Oh, yeah.
And she comes in and out throughout this documentary just
briefly.
Briefly. Yeah. Very small little blurbs. But one thing that just stuck out to me, and I had to write it down, is that she was saying that everything, all of these injuries that they're talking about, were explained away. They all had excuses for them. Nothing pointed to parental abuse, is what she says.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. What? It's just, it's far too coincidental that this one child is seemingly being beat the fuck up by every kid in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Shot in the face by a kid in the apartment complex. Like, what? It's far too often for one child.
It's so infuriating.
It really is.
It's so fucking maddening.
It is. I literally had to write that down because I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Now, Stephanie Rodriguez's boss, Kevin Baum, now he's one of the other social workers. He's the supervisor of Stephanie Rodriguez.
Yes.
So he's one of the social workers also being, you know, tried.
Correct.
And to kind of clear this up, there are four social workers, right?
Yeah.
Two of them are supervisors. Two of them are frontline social workers.
Yes.
Under them. So we have Stephanie Rodriguez. She was in the emergency response unit. Her direct supervisor is Kevin Baum.
Correct.
And then from there, it moves on to Patricia Clement, who is in the family preservation unit, and she is supervised by Gregory Merritt.
Correct. And they kind of work in tandem with each other.
Yeah.
A little bit.
So but they are separate units.
They're separate units, but they do work in tandem. That's why those four are the ones that were charged.
Right. So that kind of, in case that was a little confusing for you, it was for me up until like this episode. Really.
Yeah, me too. They kind of showed us a chart of how it worked, and then it finally clicked.
Yeah. Yeah. Because originally we were like, why would he have so many social workers? But this makes sense.
Yes.
Now, Kevin Baum says that he had had Gabriel's file for about 3 months. He had approved this was a high risk level. You know, there was general neglect, improper corporal punishment on behalf of the parents to the child. He claims that he ran the case, quote unquote, up the flagpole for more intensive services. Now, when Stephanie Rodriguez and Kevin Baum decide to close that investigation, they hand it off to Greg Merritt, preservation team, which then it is assigned to Patricia Clement. Now, Patricia Clement was known to be a problematic worker. She's one of these people you don't want to be on a team with.
And I said, that's never good.
Never good.
When you hear the word problematic, that's never good for someone.
That's not a good thing to be. It says that she was perceived to be very rude and unprofessional with clients as well as colleagues.
Well, and that made me ask the question, like, why did she continue to work directly with clients then? Wouldn't that have been notated? Because I'm sure those calls are recorded and they can hear the interaction. And someone who's rude or unprofessional in a customer service type position where you are working directly with the public, they need to be taken out.
Yeah.
In my eyes, I've seen it happen before and I'm like, that needs to stop.
Yeah.
I mean, the customer is always right. You're always nice to the customer. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. You are always wrong. Customer's always right. Be nice, always.
Right. Right. And then on the flip side too, when I heard that, my first thought was, good, because it sounds like Stephanie was too nice. So we need somebody who's not afraid to get out there. So
literally the complete opposite.
Right. Yeah. So, but who knows? We don't know in what context she's being rude. I mean, is she being rude to the children or is she being rude to the adults?
Right.
And in this case, we know that the adult is not right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure that there are cases where allegations are made and the parents are completely in the right.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Kind of one of those things.
Well, and it's always, there's always a gray area.
Always a gray area. The thing that struck me, though, is right after that statement about her being unprofessional and rude, is that they talk about how she had been a, get ready for this, because it fucking shocked me. I had to stop it and repeat it because I was like, what? I even turned on the caption, closed captioning, because right. I'm like, they had to have said that wrong. She was a nun for 10 years. And that puzzles so many people because now she's very like known to be profane and loud. Yeah. And like, I don't know.
I literally was like, what? Nuns just stop being nuns? I thought like, you're just a nun forever.
Yeah. You married God, right?
It's so weird.
Can you divorce God? I don't know.
So it's so interesting.
It was very interesting. And honestly, like every photo that you see of her, she just looks scary as shit.
She looks nasty. Like just a nasty woman that is always right. And yeah.
I feel like she would be that nun that would be like in the news for like slapping kids with rulers and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she was that like spare the rod, beat the child kind of a person.
First thing I thought. Yes.
Yeah. But it was like, what? A nun?
So weird.
Very weird.
Well, we find out that Patricia's internal affairs response was much different than her response to the district attorney when she was being interviewed.
Yeah. Yeah. Two different interviews, a couple of years apart.
Yes.
And almost opposite.
Complete 180.
Yeah.
From what she said at the beginning. So in the internal affairs interview, she basically said that she saw the black eyes, she saw the BB gun shot. She had been told that the BB gun shot was from a kid in the apartment complex. There was no body chart done.
Never.
And she lied on all of his paperwork.
Yeah.
I'm like, but why? Why are we lying? For what fucking reason? To like close the case? To like get it off her plate? Like what is the point behind it, you know?
Yeah.
So then a few years later, she gets interviewed by Mary Senevich over the phone. That was that phone call we heard at the end of last week's episode. And she said that the case was never about physical abuse, but neglect.
Are you shitting me?
Does she know that she was recorded the first time around and that she literally said something completely different?
Does she know that God is listening?
And she was a nun, for Christ's sake?
God. Whoa. Christ's sake. Oh, yes.
Oh, that's perfect. Perfect. That was perfect.
Perfect.
Oh, praise my goodness. Jesus. So, yes, she basically said that it was never about physical abuse, but neglect. There was no bruises ever seen. No one had said anything. Deemed Azaro as pleasant, upstanding, and caring. But she then mentions that she had only spoke to Azaro once on her first visit.
Yeah.
Fucking red flag.
Excuse me. For real?
Of course he's going to be pleasant and nice to you. He doesn't want to tip you off that he's beating the little 8-year-old in the back room. Like, what is wrong with you people?
I know.
Ah!
I know. I couldn't believe some of these things where, you know, she talks about him having a perfect attendance at school, even though that was during that time when he was missing a lot of school because of his injuries. What? She clearly was not actually looking into this stuff.
No.
She was just taking someone's word for it.
Yep. And we even hear that she backdated the end date for the case.
Yep.
So it happened in April, but she wrote down March 6th, so she wouldn't be responsible for any visits within that month. All I wrote is, that is so fucked up.
Seriously. Talk about, like, I don't even
know. That is pure laziness.
That is. Well, and it's fucking dishonest is what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, and trying to get someone else in trouble for something that she did. So she must have known that she had dropped the ball somewhere.
Yep. And she wanted to cover her tracks.
Because why else would you lie?
It's the only way. She wanted to keep herself safe and cover her own tracks. And she even wrote that there was no safety risks after she found out about the suicide notes.
Yeah.
Mind blown.
There's
no safety risks when you just found out that he's writing suicide notes and wants to kill himself at 8 years old?
Well, no, why would there be? Pearl said everything was fine.
God, I fucking hate Pearl.
Seriously.
We hear that Greg Merritt had basically stated he couldn't recall any further inquiry or investigation to verify any of the info that Patricia gave him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, it's every single step was missed or not looked into or not verified, or is anyone doing their job?
I feel like everyone over there is like, hands up, not it.
I don't get it.
I don't get it.
And, you know, Patricia, to me, she seemed like she had this poor me attitude.
Yeah.
She had said in the phone interview that she didn't miss anything. Crucify the person who did it, not her. Like, we understand that you didn't physically kill him yourself.
Right.
But you could have done more in your position to ensure that he didn't die at the hands of his mom and her boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
So many more things could have been done.
So many more. There's a point where she says something to the effect of, I had no control over what goes on in families.
Bitch, that's your job. Literally, that is your job description. You are there to make sure that these children stay safe and don't die from their parents or whoever they're staying with.
Yeah. And while you may not physically have the ability to go in and rip this child out of a home, you have the ability to write down everything that you see.
Exactly.
To have that child removed.
And if she would have, she would not be on trial right now.
Absolutely.
If she would have done what she's supposed to do, then it wouldn't fall on her. It wouldn't be her issue because she did everything in her power and in her jurisdiction that she could do to try and help save this child.
Exactly.
And if she would have, he would have been out of that household immediately.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we hear that Jackie Lacey states that there were affirmative things done to keep Gabriel in harm's way, and it was foreseeable that he would end up dying.
Yeah.
And it's true.
Greg Merritt's attorney, Joseph Gutierrez, says something to the effect of, well, actually, it's a quote, these social workers really aren't villains. They're really unsung heroes in this case. And I literally wrote down, what the actual fuck?
I must have missed that. I do not remember him
saying
that. I would have been throwing my fucking remote at the TV.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing you didn't see it then.
Break my new TV.
Not be happy. We then hear from Emily Carranza. Now, she is Gabriel's cousin and the founder of Gabriel's Justice.
Yes.
And she goes on to say that she's angry because they should have done their job to save that little boy. And how many more children out there, like Gabriel, are just being forgotten?
Yeah.
And in all honesty, kind of ignored because nobody went to Gabriel directly. They talked to the two people who were brutalizing him.
That should not be allowed.
It's not.
You have to go to the children, not the parents. I don't get that. If the kids can physically talk for themselves, you get them alone and isolate them and talk to them and see what they tell you.
Well, absolutely.
I mean, don't get it.
You and I are not trained in this.
No.
At all. And we know this is what you're supposed to do.
That has to be the main part of your job description to keep kids safe, is if they can talk for themselves and they know how to coherently talk about their life and what's happening, you talk to them.
Well, and you can tell just by body language, too.
Yep.
Even if they're lying to you, their body language will tell you that something is off.
Yep.
And that's when you isolate them and talk to them. But no, none of this was done. We then hear from Judge Lomelli how he had ruled in favor of the prosecution, stating that the evidence clearly shows, quote, the defendant's actions and or inactions similarly demonstrated an improper regard for human life or indifference to the consequences. Now, that right there is where the title of the episode came from.
Yeah.
He said that there would be a trial. Now, the social workers had went to an appeals court to see if they could overturn that ruling following this, to see if they could get it thrown out of going to trial.
It was their last chance, basically.
And it didn't work.
Yep.
Greg Merritt then asks, if there are failures at every level, why are only 4 social workers being tried?
This is what we talked about.
Good question.
This is what we talked about. Why the fuck aren't the officers also on trial?
I mean, because really.
they have the same opportunity to save this child and they didn't do it too.
Yep.
So I'm asking the same thing. But again, yep. like you stated, they are the law.
Yep.
So they clearly have ways around it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the director at the Children's Data Network, Emily Putnam Hornstein, comes on and she's talking about, now she's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at USC. Now, she's been working on research, focusing on using administrative records to better understand maltreated children and those involved in the child protection system. Now, she's talking about what I think a lot of us have heard of, and I think a lot of us don't really understand how it works, but she's talking about algorithms and looking at these algorithms for child risk assessments.
Yes.
Calls that should be investigated immediately versus calls that are maybe a little bit lower on the priority risk.
Correct.
They say that they have roughly between 6 to 7 million children reported for alleged abuse or neglect every year in the U.S. Now, that's a lot of investigation to do.
Right.
When you think about it, you know that some of those are going to be false allegations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be just a scorned lover or, you know, somebody in a fight with somebody and just totally trying to get sense. Back at them. But at the same time, you can't just automatically assume that that's what's happening.
Right.
So they are trying to come up with ways that technology can kind of help us out in this.
And I think it's like questions. It's questions that they ask about what's going on. And then it gives them this risk assessment, like analyzes the data that you gave them to figure out what type of risk that this child could potentially be in.
True.
It's not perfect and it's not a perfect science, but I actually kind of think it's a really sweet tool that they're using to help hopefully indicate these high and severe cases that need attention right away.
Exactly. So it sounds like what happens is the call comes in, the social worker gets the call, they look up the case in the records. They then are able to press a button to bring up this screening tool known as the Allegheny Family Screening Tool.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses historical data to predict future risk using 100 plus different factors. For example, the child welfare history, maybe the parent's history, drug use or addiction, mental illness that's been found in the family, jail time, convictions, assaults. Basically, they're looking for patterns of escalation.
Right.
Now, this gives us a number between 1 and 20, you know, being a high, medium, or low risk factor. Now, they're not quite sure if this tool would have been able to predict Gabriel's exact outcome, but it was very clear based on his notes and his records that mm-hmm. he should have been in the high risk category, and it was noted all over his file that he was high risk. Now, they also say that this tool, while it's not an exact science at this point, it is, you know, considered to be, quote unquote, better than human judgment
mm-hmm.
because it does look at a ton of other things.
Exactly.
And we know that when it comes to these algorithms, it can give you a lot of information, right? I mean, just think about that time that you looked at something on Google and all of a sudden it's popping up all over your social media feeds.
Right.
Like, how did Facebook know that I was looking up Snuggies, you know?
Right.
So these types of things, it's all a mathematical equation and it looks for things and it gives you things that they think you're going to want to look at.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the same thing in the fact that it's using a bunch of data to try to compile answers. One thing that Emily does talk about, though, is that there have always been critics to this from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I totally get that. You know, there's critics with everything. She says that they kind of worry that the tool will further bias poor and minority communities due to the overrepresentation in the data that's collected by counties. And I get that.
Yeah.
Especially if you're in a, you know, an area that's heavily populated but considered poor, for the most part, you're going to get a large representation versus if you were to go out into the suburbs.
Exactly.
Where the same shit could be happening, but it's happening behind closed doors in gated communities.
Exactly. And we get to meet for the first time Aaron Dalton.
Yes.
Who is the deputy director of Allegheny County's Office of Analysis, Technology, and Planning. And she says, of course, there is bias in our society. It's not really a function of actual child abuse, but what gets reported, of course.
Yeah.
So the Allegheny County's algorithms are publicly owned. But she states that the fear is, and the scary part is, the privately owned companies who want to work on this data and the algorithms for you who may not be doing it in the best interest of the public.
Yeah.
Which totally makes sense because it would probably be money motivated at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
And they might tweak the data to give you what you think you want to see and not what actually is happening.
What? Are you saying that that happens?
There's fraud.
Are you saying that we are fed information that we should believe but may not actually be true?
I know. It's crazy.
Is this that fake news thing?
So she also states that, and this is very true in today's society, well, just in the world in general, that people are more afraid of the new thing than business as usual.
Even if they complain about it.
Exactly. Because humans in general hate change. It's tough. It's unknown. You don't know
how it's inconvenient.
It's inconvenient. You don't know how it's going to end up.
Yep.
There's a lot of different factors that come into it. So it totally makes sense to me.
Yeah. I totally get that.
Finally, we get to the initial interviews at the LA County Sheriff's Department with Ezekiel and Virginia, who again are Gabriel's siblings.
Oh.
And you guys, this is tough. This is the tough part. It starts the tough part. We see Susan Velasquez speaking to Virginia first, and she asks her if she can define the word truth. And Virginia states, telling the real thing, not the thing you don't want to say. And then she asks her if she knows what a lie is.
Yeah.
And she says that it means you're not telling the truth. To sum it up,
I'm wondering if this seems to be kind of the normal thing that they start with children when they're interviewing them. Because isn't this the exact same thing that we talked about in Long Shot when his daughter was up on the stand?
Yep. And I think it's to gauge their perception of what these words mean.
And their moral compass maybe too.
Exactly. To see if they're going to lie to you. Because as children, they might not know that it's not okay to lie when you're speaking to police officers and or investigators.
Well, because children like to lie. Well, not that they like to lie, but children do lie to keep themselves out of trouble.
Exactly. It's almost like a safety mechanism for
them,
right?
Absolutely.
During this point, they are going back and forth from Virginia's interview to Ezekiel's interview. And we see Ezekiel's interview, and he was asked, when was the first time you saw something bad happen to Gabriel? And Ezekiel responded, he saw him pick Gabriel up and choke him. Now, when he says he saw him choke and pick him up, I would assume he's talking about Azaro.
Yeah.
AKA Tony, as they call him. We pan back to Virginia's interview, and she states that Gabriel used to clean the kitty litter.
Yeah, that sounds like that was one of his jobs.
Yep. She goes on to say that he used to say he was done, so Azaro would go check, and it was peed on. Tony would say, pick it up right, or I'll make you eat it. When Gabriel didn't pick it up right, he said, get in this corner and eat it. The interviewer, did he eat it? And she said he had to.
Yeah.
He had no choice. What a fucking bastard this guy is.
I mean, seriously.
How fucking traumatic, not only for Gabriel, but for these other kids that have to live with this. They can word for word account for what happened because it's so traumatic to them. I'm sure it's burned in their brain.
It's seriously just so out of this world.
Like, oh, this was tough. This was tough.
This was tough. Yeah. So we know now that he wasn't eating kitty litter because it was all he could get his hands on. He was being forced it as a punishment for not doing whatever chore he was told to do. Makes me sick.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're on the stand at Azaro's trial where Jonathan Hatami brings up Ezekiel and Virginia for questioning. Now, because they are minors, there are no videotapes allowed in the courtroom at this time.
Correct.
They do have the transcribed testimonies that they read off. We also have those illustrations that, you know, show us what it would be like had we actually been able to see them on the stand.
Of course, yeah.
Now, Ezekiel goes and testifies that Pearl and Azaro had kept Gabriel in the box a lot. Now, of course, we're talking about that little cabinet that they had brought in for, evidence.
I fucking hate that cabinet.
I know. So he had spent a lot of time in this box. Now, we're kind of under the impression in earlier episodes here that he had spent the night in there, but it sounds like he had also spent a lot of days in this box as well. They would gag him with a sock in the mouth at times, secure it with a bandana, and it was handcuffed closed. And sometimes he was handcuffed himself inside of the box.
Oh my God, it's just dreadful.
It's ridiculous. They said, too, that Gabriel was made to go to the bathroom in the box. They had asked, where did he go to the bathroom when he was locked up? And Ezekiel said, in the box. And a lot of times he was forced to clean it up himself. Mind you, he didn't have a choice. He had nowhere to go.
Oh, I could not imagine that. Just
I know.
The isolation and feeling alone,
but yet being able to hear everything that's going on outside.
So you know like you're a prisoner, and you don't understand why. You don't understand why you're being treated this way.
I know.
Just the thoughts that probably went through that poor little boy's mind. It makes my mother instincts kick in and want to just grab him and hug him and kiss him and tell him that he's loved, you know? Because you just would hope that he knew that, you know? But he was, it just breaks my heart.
I know. It's tough. Well, and Ezekiel also goes to say that Gabriel was hidden in this box often when social workers came to the house.
Of course he was.
Yep. So that right there is a bit of an explanation on why a lot of the social workers stated that they didn't actually see him and that they only spoke to Pearl or Azaro, but at the same time, they should have demanded to see him. However, right. I'm starting to wonder now if they're like, well, nope, he's outside playing with friends. He's gone today, but you can come talk to us. But really, he's in a box hidden in the other room.
Well, I mean, even when we saw that the sheriff had came to his house at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
You know that he's there. Right. Where else is he going to be? Like, ask the questions. Ask to see this child.
Walk into the bedroom and check to see that he's sleeping
in his bed. Like, you have the authority to do that.
Yeah.
Do something more.
I know. Ezekiel then talks about, I don't know if it was exactly just one time, but definitely an instance where he knew that his brother was hungry and that he tried to squeeze part of a banana between the cracks in the box to feed him.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
So devastating. Just the thought of what that looked like for that poor little boy. I just don't get it.
And Jonathan Hatami goes on to say that the evidence showed the level of abuse that Gabriel had undergone, but the siblings' testimonies hit him even harder.
Well, I mean,
you're hearing this. Now, at this point, you know, they're on the stand. It's 4 years later. So, you know, Ezekiel's, what, 16?
Yep,
you know, at the 16. Time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're not little voices anymore. But these are definitely going to be little voices because you don't fully grow out of that.
No.
That's something that sticks with you. And I bet those two children felt right back in that age, in that time, in that body, at that time being questioned.
Well, that changes your whole life. And I'm sure your whole makeup, your brain makeup of how you perceive life. I can't see how that wouldn't. That is so traumatizing.
Truly.
To anyone,
yeah.
Let alone a young child. I hope for their sake that they get help, that they work with someone to help them with that, because that would be haunting. To have to live with that the rest of your life, it's haunting.
Moving on with more of the interviews with Jonathan Hatami, you know, they come to find out that, you know, the teeth that were missing from Gabriel's mouth had been knocked out by Pearl while she had hit him in the mouth with the bottom side of a bat.
Oh my God.
Literally made my skin crawl. Just the thought of the impact.
Oh my, I could not imagine.
I know. And they asked him, you know, they said, Ezekiel, do you remember him crying? And he says, yes, he cried. And they said, do you remember him, you know, being taken to a doctor or a dentist? And he said, no, he was never taken to a doctor.
Could you imagine how much he bled?
No.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that'd be all over the place. And this poor boy doesn't even get any help at all.
Well, and it doesn't sound like that's where it ends, because Ezekiel also remembers a can of pepper spray that was used as evidence in the court. And he says that, yeah, that had been Azaro's pepper spray as part of his, you know, he was a security guard. So he would have had something to subdue whoever he was trying to secure a place from. But they said that he remembers Pearl and Azaro using pepper spray on Gabriel in the bathroom, how they had him in the bathtub. They were spraying him in the face with it and they had locked the door so he had nowhere to run. He couldn't leave.
That is fucking torture.
That is torture.
Fucking torture. And they are enjoying it. That is so beyond sick and twisted.
Truly.
What a fucking coward he is.
I mean, let's just hope that, you know, it is very well known in the population of whatever prison he is at for the rest of his life that they know what he did, because child abuse is not taken lightly by other inmates. No. That is not something that is glamorized.
And there are people in there that are in there for the rest of their life. So do you think they give two shits what they're going
to
do this
year? They have nothing to lose.
They have nothing to lose. They're staying there forever anyway. So they know they're not leaving.
Yeah.
And again, people don't take lightly to child abuse. So
they sure don't. Well, and Ezekiel also goes on to say that he remembers Pearl and Nazaro calling Gabriel gay a lot. That was a term that they used a lot when talking about him. He said that they would try to cover up his injuries with makeup and that they would make him sit in cold baths to try to make the bruises go away faster, which, I'm sorry, that takes away swelling. That doesn't take away coloration in the skin.
Well, they're not the brightest people.
What?
Well,
and they seem to get away with a lot.
I don't understand it. I think it's pure luck, honestly. I don't understand it. But then they say that when he's out of this cold bath, he just has to go into the cupboard again.
Yeah.
It's like, can you imagine just being cold and wet and bruised up and
bleeding and then going into a hard, cold cupboard?
And literally in my notes, it just says in caps locks, fucking monsters. We talked about at the beginning of this trial.
Yep.
If Azaro and Pearl were actually monsters or not, or was this a mistake, blind rage?
Sure.
Fucking monsters.
Nope. This was torture.
This was fucking torture.
You can't write that any other way.
No. Azaro got some joy out of doing this to him and he did it for months. So it's not a one time he lost his goddamn mind. Nope. Right. He's a fucking monster and he deserves to be in prison for the rest of his goddamn life.
Yes.
Now we get to the part where they're explaining to the jury what happened the actual night that Gabriel died.
Yeah.
We hear from Ezekiel that he had gotten back from playing outside and Pearl and Virginia and Gabriel were inside Virginia's room. They were arguing about something. Pearl got mad that Gabriel was playing with Virginia's toys and started hitting him in the face.
Yeah, I think it has to go back to that whole gay thing again.
I don't understand. And then she dragged him into her room. That's when Azaro went in and they closed the door. He said he heard screaming and a lot of banging. His mom came out and Ezekiel was scared. I can only imagine.
Seriously.
Like, he knows how badly Gabriel's already tortured, and then he hears screaming and banging. He knew something serious had to have happened.
Yeah.
And he said, she told me to tell the police or paramedics that we were playing and that he hit his head. Of course, here she goes with her manipulation and making sure that she has her story straight with her kids and that her kids are telling the same thing that she's going to tell them.
And interesting that she always blames the children.
Always. Yeah, she always puts it on them because she knows that nothing's going to happen to them. Kids will be kids, right? And she doesn't really give a shit. She only cares about herself. She doesn't care about her kids.
Well, and imagine the incredible amount of guilt that these two children must feel because of all of the lies that they were told to say.
Right.
To protect Pearl and Azaro.
Right.
When they literally didn't do it. They were following orders.
Exactly.
And that's a lot.
And I think their reality is all a little skewed because reality has been mostly a lie.
Right.
And everything that they've had to live their life by has been a lie.
Absolutely.
So I think that's probably hard to get out of and get back to some sort of normalcy.
Yeah.
Right? Virginia is now on the stand and she states that she was sitting on the edge of the bed and Azaro was punching him or punching Gabriel. He knocked the air out of him and he didn't get back up. So they picked him up, threw him in the shower, and Azaro kept yelling at him to wake up. When he didn't wake up, Pearl decided to call the police. She told me to grab a rag and clean up all the blood.
Yeah.
Could you imagine telling your young child to clean up all the blood?
Before the police get there?
Oh my God. It's completely unimaginable and so horrifying as an adult.
Oh my God.
I could not imagine as a prepubescent child that is so naive and doesn't know really what's going on or that maybe this isn't normal.
Yeah.
This isn't normal life. This, right. They think it might be, right?
Yeah. Well, that's all they've ever known.
Exactly. And they say that while these children were testifying, there was no emotion on Azaro at all.
Yeah.
Because you know, he didn't give two shits. He didn't care.
Yeah. They said the whole courtroom was like in tears of during course. These testimonies. And he sat there stoic, staring forward, never blinking.
Nope, because he knew that all of it was true.
Yep.
He did every single bit of it and never shed one goddamn tear.
Oh, he knew he was fucked three ways from Sunday.
Yep. We did learn that Ezekiel and Virginia now live in a stable home with their uncle.
Yeah.
And again, I really do hope that they can recover, seek some sort of help or therapy, because abuse is something that happened to you.
Yeah.
It's not something that you did.
It's not a part of you.
Exactly. And we hear that from one of the talking heads here who is a therapist.
Yeah.
And it's true. But I think as a child, you want to blame yourself because you don't understand why this happened to you, right?
Yeah.
You don't get it. None of it makes logical sense. None of this case makes logical sense. I was going to say,
even as an adult, this doesn't make sense.
No.
But at the same time, children internalize so many things. They don't know how to handle those situations. And these kids were never given a fighting chance.
No, not at all. And we see at the very end of the episode, it kind of pans back to the initial interviews.
Yeah.
With Virginia and with Ezekiel. And Virginia had said that she was sad. She never told Gabriel she was sorry for not letting him play with her. She said he always stayed in the dark with no one. And you could tell she was choking up tears as she was saying this to the investigator. And I can only imagine she probably feels like that was her fault, right?
Absolutely.
Of course it's not. Kids will be kids. Kids are playing with their friends. They don't always want to play with their siblings, right?
Well, and think about it this way too. If Pearl is always yelling at him about being gay, she most likely said something to Virginia along the lines of, don't let him play with you and your friends. That's a boy. Right. You guys are playing with girl stuff.
Right.
So I'm guessing there was also a little bit of a fear in her to allow him to play.
Exactly. There was probably so many factors as to why. But as a child, you take that internally after this bad thing happened and think that it is somehow your fault.
Absolutely.
When in no way, shape, or form it is.
No.
Then at the very end, Ezekiel was speaking with the lead investigator, and the one thing that stuck out to me was he said, the guy in charge says that none of this was your fault. Ugh. Basically stating that when you go to bed tonight, just remember, the guy in charge told you that this is none of your fault. And I'm like,
right.
I fucking love that. As an investigator, that is fucking awesome to do for a child because they don't know.
Yeah.
They really are all over the place. They're in an investigation room or interrogation room with an investigator, right? I'm sure they probably think that some of it is their fault because they listened to their parents.
Right.
They listened and were told to lie and they did that.
Yeah.
Because they probably didn't want to get hurt, right?
Absolutely.
So I just thought that was so cool, so awesome. I loved the way that they ended that. Just to make sure that
it was a good one.
Yes, that just to make sure that the kids knew that it was not their fault and to always remember that.
Yeah, I liked that too. That was so heartwarming. Oh, holy shit. That was by far the hardest episodes for me.
Yes, me too. I think just that real testimony from someone who was there the night he died and could actually give us like a real timeline of what happened. It makes it so much more eye-opening and real.
Agreed.
I mean, you know it's real, but when someone was there seeing it firsthand and their children that are telling the story, it's horrifying and devastatingly sad.
For sure. And as hard as this one was, we still have one more to go.
One more to go. And I think this is the longest episode of the series. So it'll be very interesting to see how much they get into this episode. So next week's episode might be pretty long, guys.
It might be a big one.
Just warning you.
Yeah. But it'll be good. We're certainly ready to wrap up the series. So we really hope that you join us. As always, join our Facebook group, Sheer Crime Podcast Discussion Group. You can send us all your requests, your memes, send us something fun about your day. We'd love to hear from you.
Literally whatever.
We're real people. You're real people.
Yes.
Let's have some real fucking conversation.
Yes.
Don't forget to follow our personal social media pages at Amy_Sawada. That's AME_SOWADA. And MMillard08. That's MMILLARD08 on all of the things.
Yep.
And not to sound like a broken record, because I'm not going to have to tell you every single time to go out there, rate and review us on iTunes, because you know what? I feel like you already did that. And if you didn't,
right,
go fucking do it. All right, guys. Well, that's all we have for you today.
Yes. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Yes. We will be back next week with the final episode of The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. Until then, don't forget, never run with scissors. Bye.
See ya.